Dr. Michael Sala is a pioneer in the development of exopolitics. He's the author of several books, his most recent exposing U.S. government policies on extraterrestrial life. And Dr. Sala was an assistant professor, researcher, and residence in the School of International Service at the American University from 1996 to 2004. He has a Ph.D. in government from the University of Queensland in Australia, founder of the Exopolitics Institute. And Michael, it's always a pleasure to have you on Coast to Coast. How are you?
Great, George. I'm glad to be back. Lots of interesting things have been happening.
Gosh, I remember the days we were talking when you were still at the American University, but you were so vocal, so determined to get this subject out that we think it cost you that job. Remember that day?
Sure do. It was a fascinating experience for me to just see how even universities, a progressive university with supportive faculty, when it comes to this issue of extraterrestrial life, people just really just clam up. I mean, they don't want to go there, even though the evidence is so persuasive.
Michael, tell us how you got interested in this. What was it that drove you as far as you've been going with this?
Well, it really was that Disclosure Project press conference that Dr. Greer organized back in May of 2001, and I saw that pretty soon after it happened, and it was something that really just got my attention. I mean, I thought all of the witnesses that were called up were very persuasive, very sincere. They had good, solid credentials, and basically for the next 20 months, I just researched the things that they said and whatever information I could find on the internet. And it was something that I eventually concluded that this was just more than anything that I had covered up until that time, explained what was really happening behind the scenes internationally. And so I really made a big decision of studying that phenomenon and moved away from the area that I was working in at the university at the time, which was peace and conflict resolution.
And your colleagues probably thought, you know, what are you doing, Michael? What are you doing, right?
Well, that's right. People were just very skeptical that this was something that anyone could really study and maintain any kind of university status. I mean, the people I mentioned it to, I mean, they were interested while I was at the university. They were interested, faculty, colleagues, and so forth. But they just didn't want to go there. They just said, well, you know, we're still looking for tenure. We still want to get our tenure here, and this is something that would kill us. And that was pretty much the kind of reception I got. And anyone that was going to pursue this issue in any kind of official research capacity was really risking their career and their connection with the university.
Michael, the Washington Post has a series called Top Secret America. Tell me about your thoughts on why you think it's important with what you're doing, and that's trying to get the truth out about UFOs and ET life.
Well, it's a very important development. I mean, what happened last week, there were three articles that the Washington Post released that were part of this Top Secret America, along with an interactive blog site with a lot of links and a lot of online information people can check. Because previously, when it came to top secrecy, classification, national security, the media in the U.S. is pretty reticent to go anywhere into any great detail, into any issue that involves national security. Typically, this is the sort of thing that editors will step in and tell any reporter that it's not something that they should write about because it really does kind of focus on national security. So I think what's happened is that there's been a culture over the last decades concerning national security and secrecy, and anything that's classified top secret and above is automatically out of bounds for any mainstream reporter. It's like they just know that this is not an area that they could write about and that it's something that they could actually publish without it bringing them great grief or their editor just putting a stop to it. So what happened with this Washington Post series is that I think that they have really placed a great big dent in that culture that you can't write about national security. Now I think a lot of people are paying attention that, well, it's actually okay to talk about national security issues, and that in fact, when it comes to these national security projects, there may be the same kind of problems in terms of redundancy problems, wasted expenditures and so forth, that really are part of the kind of mainstream political arena, so we can write about it. And that's a really important development.
If you would look at also what the Washington Post is trying to reveal in its work, one can conclude that there is some incredible top-secret classified work being kicked back to corporate contractors, much more sensitive material than used to be years ago, I would assume, right?
Well, that's another area that the Washington Post series really did cast a lot of light on, the role of the contractors. Those are corporations that bid for contracts offered by various intelligence or defense departments, agencies, and so forth, projects that deal with top secret programs or compartmented programs, and that what the Post did was basically lay out the kind of the political geography of how these contractors go about bidding and getting these very lucrative deals, often by hiring former intelligence or defense personnel, paying them exorbitant rates. I mean, they're very well paid, and so they get very talented personnel, and they go out there, and their job is to help them get these really lucrative contracts that are offered through different government agencies, departments, and so forth. And that this is something that has really become a dominant part of how the intelligence community and the Defense Department do business now. If you want to get something done, something top secret, something that is very, very sensitive, you don't go to your own people in your own department. You basically look to a corporation to take control of the whole issue and run the project for you, and you just pay them.
Now, this classified work that's being done, why will that help or hurt disclosure?
Well, a lot of this classified work that is done, I mean, the more that it's placed in the hands of corporations, the harder it is for individuals to gain any kind of access or any kind of accountability, simply because when it comes to federal employees, whether you're talking about people in different government agencies, departments, military departments, and so forth, these are people who typically have kind of whistleblower protection laws, so that if they come out and they talk about wrongdoing, they have a certain degree of protection. I mean, that's one thing. When it comes to freedom of information requests, I mean, you can't request a corporation to disclose sensitive information dealing with a topic. I mean, basically, there's no provision that exists for a private individual to find out what's going on in a corporation. It's all proprietary. The only area where you're going to have any success with the Freedom of Information Act is in the public sector. We're talking about the government bureaucracy, military departments, and so forth, who by law are obliged to respond. I mean, they always have an opt-out clause whereby they can cite national security and not respond to a FOIA request. But finally, the most important development is Congress. You know, the U.S. Congress has subpoena power. They can basically get any federal employee to come in and basically testify before a committee. And even if it deals with top secrecy classification, compartmentalized programs, they can still request an employee to come in and testify. So that way, at the very least, you can have Congress being informed. Now, what happens when you have a lot of these projects put in the hands of corporations, Congress doesn't have that kind of power. They just can't simply subpoena an employee of a corporation to come in and testify. And the problem here is when it comes to disclosure, more and more of these UFO, ET-related projects are placed in the hands of corporations. So it's becoming harder and harder to get confirmation or any information about what's going on.
Michael, in your book, Exposing U.S. Government Policies on Extraterrestrial Life, what do you see out there as the most damaging of information that's been out there? hanging out there?
Well, there's really a lot out there that is very damaging. I think one of the areas that is very noteworthy is the black budget, because I think if you really want to find out what is going on, you follow the money trail. Now, how is the money generated to basically pay off for these incredible series of projects dealing with all sorts of classified issues related to UFOs, advanced technologies, extraterrestrial life, and so forth? You need to find a way to pay for all of this. You can't do it through any kind of appropriations coming through Congress, because Congress has oversight over that, and they can find out, well, you know, you requested a few billion dollars for this project, you know, just tell us a little bit about it. So Congress can do that, but if you fund it, all these projects off the books, then you don't have any accountability at all. You don't have anyone basically coming in saying, oh, we want oversight of this program, whether it's Congress, whether it's the Department of Defense, or anyone coming in. And so this is why the book has a whole chapter dedicated to the black project, to the black budget. This is the money that is raised through kind of very illicit mechanisms to fund all of these ET-related projects.
By the way, our ever-alert webmaster Lex Lonehood has got the Top Secret America Washington Post series linked at our Twitter feed right now. I hear a little cat in the background, Michael.
Yes, I have a little cat there.
She's hungry, or she wants to be part of this interview. I'm not sure which. Huh?
I think she wants to say what her thoughts are on this whole ET question.
You never know. Tell me a little bit about this, you know, and as you know, Edgar Mitchell is a regular guest on the program here. But there was an incident with an Admiral Wilson. What was that?
Well, that's a very important incident. And Edgar Mitchell and Stephen Greer were involved in a briefing of a Navy admiral who at the time in 1997 was the head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So he at the time was a two-star admiral and eventually became a three-star admiral. And Stephen Greer and Edgar Mitchell informed him about a project that dealt with UFO technologies. And so this admiral went through his own sources, his own channels, to find out what was going on in this project to see if there was anything to what Edgar Mitchell and Stephen Greer had told him. Well, as it turned out, when Greer and Mitchell saw him again and followed up, he was, as it was reported by both Greer and Mitchell, he was very angry because he was denied access to this project that, according to Dr. Greer and Mitchell, related to UFO technology. So he was denied access. And one of the things that Richard Dolan actually was able to find out in his own research into this, that he found a reliable source, that in fact it was a corporate contractor who denied the admiral access to this particular set of information. And so that's a very important example of just how powerful corporations have become behind the scenes, where even the sitting head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff is denied access to a UFO-related project. That really tells you where the power is these days.
How much money do you think has been filtered into these black ops programs, Michael?
Well, there's various ways of being able to kind of estimate that. I mean, the official kind of black budget, as it's known, is around $40 billion, and that's money that is kind of funneled through various defense department projects to fund the CIA and the intelligence community. That's what's known as the official black budget, and Congress basically mandated that. So that's law, according to the CIA Act. But what is not known is this much larger budget, this black budget, a kind of unofficial black budget. So there's really two black budgets. There's the official black budget that people like Stephen Aftergood in the Federation of American Scientists reports on. And then there's an unofficial black budget, and that's the black budget that is raised through all of these illicit funds. And the best estimate of that is the way in which money is moved through the Department of Defense. And so what is a real clue as to what this to the real size of the black budget is the Inspector General reports from 1998 to 99 to the year 2000 of how much money was flowing through the Department of Defense that was not being accounted for, that there was no proper auditing mechanisms being met for this. And the average for those 3 years was $1.7 trillion. So that's more than double the current Department of Defense budget.
That's huge.
It's an incredible amount of money, and I mean, that really is gives you an idea of exactly how much money is being moved around to fund all of these kinds of illicit programs, or should I say deep black programs that are not known to the Congress and even to many people, many senior officers in the Department of Defense.
Astronomers over the weekend announced that they found about 700 more planets because of the Kepler mission, of which they think 140 of them could be Earth size, maybe even Earth-like. It's probably just a matter of time, Michael, before they find many, many more with probably civilizations on it that we've all talked about over the years on this program. But what are they hiding in terms of the government hiding of this information? I've always just pondered that question. What are they afraid of?
Well, I think there's many areas that they're very concerned about. I mean, I think one of the initial things that happened was the way in which the military really implemented a lot of top secrecy around this, to just kind of keep it away from the hands of Congress, keep it away from the public while they studied it. And I think that you can make a good argument for why that was probably the prudent thing to do back in the 1940s and 50s, that here was something that involved technologies that were literally out of this world. No one really understood how they operated, and no one was really certain as to the motivations of the beings behind these technologies. And so there was a lot of secrecy that was implemented to deal with this and to study it, and I think that's the way it began. It began as a kind of top-secret study and reverse engineering, and the Eisenhower administration really began the monumental task of studying this in a very systematic way, and got corporations involved. And I think what's happened over the decades is that more and more the control and real authority over these issues has been placed in the hands of kind of quasi-governmental committees that are embedded within international corporations, and that the real authority has been taken out of legitimate government entities, so that you don't have either the Congress, the President of the United States, nor even the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the other senior people within the Department of Defense or the intelligence community really having any direct oversight and control over this. And I think if I was to try to kind of summarize it all now as to why we're not getting disclosure, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that those that ought to be in charge aren't in charge, and they're embarrassed by it. I mean, you think about it. Why would the Department of Defense come forward and basically reveal to the American public, well, extraterrestrial life is real, and we've known about this for the 1940s, and really we don't have control because we're not given the latest information anymore, and the real power is in the hands of these corporations and these kind of nebulous committees that we don't know who's sitting on them. So that's a big problem.
Michael, stay with us. I want to talk about this sighting in China and what people have been seeing around this country recently. We'll be back. Michael, over the 4th of July weekend, people all around the Midwest reported seeing strange objects, not fireworks. They reported it to Peter Davenport's National UFO Reporting Center. Have you heard anything about what that might have been?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, obviously around the anniversary of the Roswell crash. But no, I haven't heard any reports about that particular set of UFO sightings.
Okay. We have had pictures up for the last few weeks about this very bizarre episode in China, of which some people claim that it has military applications. I don't know. The picture I've seen doesn't look anything from this world. What's your take on all this, and what happened exactly?
Well, it's a really interesting case. What happened was that on July 7, there was a UFO that was seen in the vicinity of one of the major city airports. Hangzhou is the city, and the regional airport there was Zhaoshan International Airport. And this UFO was sighted around 9 o'clock in the evening, and it led to a shutdown of the airport for close to an hour. It was 18 flights had to be diverted to another nearby airport before they opened it up. And the interesting thing was that on July 9, just 2 days later, a number of the Chinese media ran stories about the UFO closing down the airport. And it's important to keep in mind that in China, it's still a very tightly controlled society, that the media doesn't put things out unless the political elite are satisfied and happy about that. And so this was some of the leading official organs for the Chinese Communist Party that actually allowed these stories to come out. And accompanying the stories were a couple of photos of the UFO that looked like a kind of cylindrical object with lights and so forth. And so what happened then was that the story went around the world, and the photos then got essentially kind of mixed up with a lot of other photos that had nothing to do with the airport. The initial story run by the People's Daily, the two photos used in that were photographed by a local resident at the time of the UFO sighting in China, in the city of Hangzhou. And what happened was that when the Western media got to it, you had the ABC News and MSNBC and the Los Angeles Times and so forth running stories, and they were mixing up those photos with unrelated photos that really had nothing to do with that sighting. And then there were some videos were thrown in that also had nothing to do with the sighting. So what eventually happened was that a weapons analyst from MIT got to look at all of this photos, the videos, and basically concluded at the end that that they were all fake, that there were some problems with them, and that they had nothing to do with the China sighting. And so the whole thing kind of like didn't get that much media coverage because the media was using a lot of kind of fake photos and video that really had nothing to do with the sighting, and that was debunked. So it was almost as though there was someone wanting the China UFO story to be debunked and kind of mixed it up, mixed up the photos that were taken with some unrelated photos that really were just misidentifications of other objects, whether it's planes or rockets and so forth. And then there was a kind of a more recent development, which was a team of researchers from Shanghai and Beijing. They went and they tried to find out what was going on. Of course, they tried to find out what was going on from the Chinese aviation authorities and didn't make much headway there. And then they interviewed some of the witnesses that took photos and analyzed the photos that appeared in the People's Daily, the first one. And their conclusion was that, well, this was not a UFO, but it was a misidentified airplane. And so that immediately raises the question, well, was that what closed the airport? And there's no way that a major regional airport like that would close because air traffic controllers somehow confused an airplane for a UFO. There was something else going on.
Right.
But it seems that the photo that was used was not really the legitimate UFO. That seems to be the conclusion now at the moment.
Okay, so the one we've seen, which kind of has all the small little lights along the base of it, that's not the real one, you're saying?
Well, that was the one that was initially published. So that was taken on July 7 of something in the vicinity of Hangzhou Airport. Now, according to these UFO investigators from Shanghai and Beijing, that is just a misidentified plane. I mean, that's their conclusion.
Well, it doesn't look like a plane to me.
Right. Well, it's a very strange object. But nevertheless, they still left open the possibility that even though the photo, in their opinion, was not a genuine UFO in the sense of an ET vehicle, they still did leave open the possibility that there was an extraterrestrial vehicle that closed the airport. It was just that the photos were not of that. So there was a lot of kind of confusion over exactly what that means now, because you have an official story from the Chinese media sanctioned by the government talking about a UFO closing an airport with photos that apparently Chinese UFO researchers now say are not of the UFO that closed the airport. And so the whole thing is pretty confusing until you start to kind of hear from some of the kind of more confidential reports of what's going on. And I have a colleague in Hong Kong, Neil Gould, who runs Exopolitics Hong Kong. Okay. And he actually has some sources inside of mainland China. And one of the sources that he used basically told him that the object actually was sighted first by an airline. So there was a pilot involved in that sighting. And that what happened then was that somehow the UFO damaged or interfered with the radar for the air traffic control at Hangzhou Airport, and that the radar failed. Now, obviously, when you have something like that happening, that's a kind of national security issue. And so that would explain why the government kind of came in so quickly and declared that this was something that they didn't want people to be talking about, and there were sources being cited saying, well, this is a military affair now, and basically that's a code for everyone in the Chinese media to basically be quiet, don't talk about this.
Yeah, back off, right?
Exactly. And no one in China is going to do anything to get the government upset there, because it is still very tightly controlled. But I think my personal reading of this is that even though you have kind of a lot of kind of mixed information there, the bottom line was that the Chinese authorities sanctioned some of their leading media newspapers to report the incident to begin with, and then they wanted to see what the Western reaction would be. And I think that there's probably people in China that are wondering, well, what if we were the ones that were to break the secrecy, you know, the international secrecy over UFOs and extraterrestrial life? What would happen if we did that? Would it be to our benefit? I think they would see lots of benefits for China personally in doing that. And they probably just wanted to test the waters and see what the Western reaction would be. And I think what we saw in terms of some of the leading U.S. Newspapers, television programs, and so forth, kind of very grossly mixing the photos that were taken on July 7 with kind of a lot of misidentifications and fakes, that I think that they would conclude that, well, if we ever did go forward and disclose that UFOs were here and we put out the evidence, the Western media would spin it so badly for us that we'd be made to look like fools. So they're probably looking at that maybe that might not be worth it for them to do that.
Well, that's a good point. What's your gut tell you, Michael? What do you think this was?
I think it was a real extraterrestrial vehicle that basically hovered over the airport or did things to some of the equipment there that led to the airport closing down. Now, whether it was a radar malfunction or that actually was what caused the airport shut down, but I think ultimately there was some kind of ET-related vehicle involved, because that would be the sort of technology that could lead to radars malfunctioning like that.
Well, I think so, too. And back to the Chinese newspapers that backed off on all of this. No whistleblowers there, though, huh?
The only people they referred to were people in the aviation authority that were commenting about the UFO to begin with in the initial reports, and they didn't give any names, but they just mentioned them, and then someone that was also unnamed that was saying that this was something that had to do with the government, it was a military affair, and that it was really a national security issue, and so that was really where things began to just go quiet.
Yeah, and quiet indeed. Stephen Hawking, a few months ago, talked about extraterrestrial life, and he basically said, back off, don't try to contact them, they're not as friendly as you think. Why would he do that?
Well, that was a really important development there with Stephen Hawking, because what he did was he legitimated scientific debate or questioning about the motivations of extraterrestrial life. And he was basically beginning with the premise that while there are just so many planets out there, solar systems out in the galaxy, that it's almost certain that extraterrestrial life is real, and that some of it would be advanced, intelligent life that would have the kind of resources to be able to roam through the galaxy. And his reading was that while they would more likely than not be like the conquistadors, you know, basically predatory resource gatherers looking for worlds to conquer and resources to plunder. And he was basically making the argument that if intelligent extraterrestrial life exists out there with all of these advanced technologies capable of traveling through the galaxy, that more likely than not, they are going to be like the conquistadors and basically look at the Earth as a place to be conquered and resources to be plundered. And so Hawking's advice was, well, we shouldn't kind of be doing things to let them know that we're here. Now, I mean, I would disagree with that, and I think a lot of scientists would disagree with his analysis. But I think it was really important that he was saying that this kind of debate is legitimate within a scientific community, that scientists, that it's perfectly rational. That was the phrase he used. It's perfectly rational for scientists to ask these questions.
Well, that's absolutely true. As you know, David Jacobs has said that he, too, believes that there's a different non-friendly purpose going on here, too.
Well, that's right. But, I mean, it's good to contrast that with what the Vatican had put out in 2009. The senior astronomer for the Vatican's observatory, Gabriel Funes, he's the chief astronomer, he was the person that put out initial stories saying that, well, if extraterrestrial life exists out there, then they are our brothers, and that they, it's more likely than not that they're going to be more ethically evolved than us. And so you have basically the diametrical opposite argument to what Hawking was saying, that the Vatican's chief astronomer, who was basically saying this with the blessing of Pope Benedict, that he was saying that advanced extraterrestrial life are going more likely than not to be our brothers. And this is that is the position that I think would be most comfortable for the Vatican to support in terms of extraterrestrial life eventually being discovered.
When do you think this breaks loose, Michael? Really breaks loose? You know, Stephen Bassett has been talking about for the last 14 years that, you know, disclosure's coming. It still doesn't come. When could this happen?
Well, I really thought that if it was likely to happen under the Obama administration, that it was more likely than not to happen sometime before the end of last year or the beginning of this year, because as we progress more into 2010, because it's an election year, the political environment becomes more and more partisan. So I think disclosure with a so-called Big D, which is a government announcement, we probably will have to wait until after the election cycle is over before that can go forward, because I think one of the things is that an announcement like that is so monumental that it would really require a kind of broad consensus among the political elite to deal with this, because this is not something that you can kind of announce and for there to be a lot of kind of public infighting. There has to be a unified front. And I think that this would be one of the things that Obama would be looking for in coming forward with an announcement. I think personally he's been briefed. I think some of the people around him that he's appointed to very senior positions know about the UFO issue, know about extraterrestrial life, and that he's been briefed in some way about this, but not enough to kind of like go public, and And when the time is right for him to go public, then he will do it. But I think one of the requirements is consensus. So I think we have to look at, say, 2011, after this election cycle, before there can be any kind of announcement from the Obama administration.
Well, when it comes, how do you think it would come, Michael? In what form or fashion?
Well, I think we're kind of seeing that now. I mean, you mentioned just before the discovery from the Kepler Space Telescope, the discoveries of Earth-like or Earth-sized planets out there, that I think there'll be kind of scientific breakthroughs in terms of they've found Earth-like planets in the habitable zone, and then maybe some telltale signs of life. Maybe SETI, that's when SETI might come into its own, where there might be some announcement that they've discovered radio signals. Or maybe it'll be a scenario like Richard Hoagland has described, where there'll be kind of artifacts on the moon or Mars that are announced. I think it'll be something like that people can wrap their minds around, in terms of some distant event, you know, something occurring far away in the solar system or elsewhere in the galaxy related to extraterrestrial life, proving that extraterrestrials are real. And then it would kind of go step by step from then on. But you really don't have to make any announcement about UFOs with extraterrestrials visiting the Earth to be able to announce that extraterrestrial life is real. You can just use the gradual opening up of the scientific community to the extraterrestrial issue as the medium by which you can introduce that to the world.
Maybe that's one of the reasons, Michael, governments want to control us right now. You know, maybe they sense that this is happening. Maybe it's out of their control, and they figure once we know about it officially, it's Katie barred the door. They can't do anything about it.
Well, I think they really have to be very, very careful, because we're having more and more whistleblowers coming forward, telling what they've been involved in, what they've seen. We're having more leaks now. I mean, you had that WikiLeaks issue that's just come up over the weekend. Exactly. So it's becoming harder and harder with the internet and the way in which information is now very quickly put out. It wouldn't take very much in terms of a disgruntled scientist in some black project to kind of put a lot of information on a DVD and send it off to an organization like WikiLeaks anonymously, and they put it out on the net, and then all of a sudden, you know, this issue is blown. And so I think governments don't want to lose face, and so they really want to be ahead of this issue. If it were to break in the media, they want to be on the public record that they were kind of letting this information out rather than it surprising them.
Next hour, we'll talk about some incredible stories that Michael has looked at on Coast to Coast AM. Over the course of this hour, we're going to talk about some incredible cases and stories with Dr. Michael Sala. And Michael, one, of course, not too long ago, a former legislator from the state of New Hampshire is trying to get some information, Henry McElroy. Tell me about him.
Well, he was very interesting. He was someone that served in the New Hampshire legislature in the early 2000s. And he was on one of the committees. It was an international relations or commerce committee. I can't remember the exact name of the committee. But he says while he was serving on that committee, he was given a one-page briefing document that was shown to President Eisenhower. And this document talked about extraterrestrial life. It talked about President Eisenhower being given the opportunity of meeting with these extraterrestrials, and that they were described in basically very benevolent terms, that they were kind of here to help, they were really monitoring the Earth, and that the military authorities were trying to decide what to do. And so this was something that he says he saw in his capacity as a member of that particular committee, and that it really was a genuine briefing document of one page that was intended for President Eisenhower. And he went on the record, he did a video on YouTube where it went out, where he just talked about his experience, and then basically just faded from the scene. A number of people tried to reach him. I also actually did speak to him on the phone, and he did not want to answer any questions. He simply said that this was something that he has already said all he's going to say about, and he's not going to answer any questions, and that was it.
He didn't deny it, though, did he?
Oh, no, not at all. No, I mean, he said this was something that he experienced. He didn't in any way disavow what he wrote about. I mean, he has been quite clear that this is what he experienced, and he's not going to say anything more than what's already been put out there on the YouTube and also in response to some questions that were relayed to him by the people who interviewed him and put the interview up on the YouTube. So he does have some intermediaries that were relaying questions back and forth. But essentially, he has just made this remarkable statement, put it on the public record in the form of a testimony on YouTube, and has now just kind of like said he's not going to comment about it anymore.
What happened to him? Did somebody get to him?
I'm not sure exactly why he is behaving in this way. It is quite odd. I did speak with someone who had worked with him while McElroy was serving in the state of New Hampshire, and it had to do with certain taxation issues. And so he was someone who genuinely did represent the state of New Hampshire, and he was very active in promoting certain progressive causes. And so it was a surprise when I told this person about McElroy's statement on the ET issue. He just wasn't aware of that. But nevertheless, I mean, it's now part of the public record. And what it does is it helps support other people who have come forward and said that they have known about President Eisenhower, having had meetings with extraterrestrials, you know, whether they were personally present, whether they saw documents, or whether loved ones told them about, you know, what they saw, what they experienced. You know, there are quite a number of people now, probably around a dozen or so, who have come forward over the last 4 or 5 years, who have said things about Eisenhower having met extraterrestrials in the 1950s. And so McElroy's statement just kind of helps add to the kind of growing amount of evidence that, in fact, there was a set of meetings that President Eisenhower did attend with extraterrestrials.
Did this McElroy seem angry with the fact that anybody would even inquire about this anymore with him?
Oh, no, he wasn't angry at all. He was not wanting to be contacted and asked questions about his statement. He basically just wanted people to go through these intermediaries, and that was it. But he wasn't prepared to kind of answer anyone's questions, and I think he's just wanting to keep his secret, his own privacy. He's a retired gentleman now. I mean, he has retired from public life. He did stand for election in the 2008, I believe. That was the last time he stood for election, and he actually did win the primary as a Republican for the state of New Hampshire, but he didn't actually get elected. And I think he since that time has retired from public life, and now he has moved down to the state of Virginia.
The late Philip Corso, we've talked about on this program a lot with his work the day after Roswell with Bill Burns. Yet last month, there was a video interview about him released, an old one, obviously, talking about personally briefing Attorney General then Robert Kennedy. What is that one about?
Well, that is a really exciting development. People have been wondering, well, what exactly President Kennedy knew about UFOs. And, you know, there's been all sorts of interesting speculation, and a lot of it's very suggestive. You know, certain documents that have been leaked saying that President Eisenhower had, President Kennedy had contacted the CIA director to find out about UFOs and so forth. So we have a lot of kind of claims like that. Mm-hmm. But now we have a direct testimony from someone who actually was serving during the Kennedy administration. I mean, during the time of Kennedy's administration, Corso was working at the Foreign Technology Desk for the Army's Research and Development Division. So, you know, he was actually a lieutenant colonel running a particular branch of a very secretive desk at the Department of Defense. And he was working directly with his mentor, a Lieutenant General Trudeau. And so Corso, in that testimony, that video testimony that I believe was made in 1998, shortly before he died, he basically said that what happened was that he was able to speak with the Attorney General, Robert Kennedy, back in 1962, and there was more than one meeting, that there were several meetings with the President's brother, and that he told Robert Kennedy about UFOs, about the technology, and that some of this technology was really critical for taking America into this new age of high-tech society. And the interesting thing is that this is exactly the job that Corso was assigned to do in the Department of Defense by his superior, Lieutenant General Trudeau. So it's very feasible that, in fact, Kennedy was seeking information about UFOs, and once he learned that Corso was someone that was willing to talk about it, Robert Kennedy made the contact, and Robert Kennedy was briefed about it. And nothing that Robert Kennedy found out about UFOs was kept from the president. I mean, that was something Corso himself pointed out in the interview.
It went right direct to him, I'm sure.
Exactly. And so that is a really direct testimony that the president knew about UFOs and extraterrestrial life. I mean, there have been a few people that have come forward that said that the president spoke about UFOs. One was William Holden, a Project Camelot witness who was a steward on Air Force One. And he said that President Kennedy on a flight to Germany commented about a newspaper story of UFOs, saying that, in fact, yes, he believed that there were extraterrestrials out there. And there was a colonel that Stephen Greer interviewed as part of the Disclosure Project that also served on Air Force One, and that this colonel was apparently told by President Kennedy directly that that he knew UFOs were real, but that he was denied access, that he wasn't given control of this. Hmm. And so that's also part of the public record. But here you have now Corso basically posthumously published his video testimony that, in fact, he personally briefed Kennedy's brother and that Kennedy knew about UFOs. And this has really important implications for those who have been seeing some kind of link between what happened ultimately to President Kennedy and the UFO issue. And I've written a series of papers, and the most recent was published in the ExoPolitics Journal. So your listeners can just go to exopoliticsjournal.com, and there's a free article, and they can read it about President Kennedy and his quest to find out what was going on with UFOs and how that was related to his assassination. So, I put together all of the evidence that I could find, and now you have Philip Corso's testimony that can be added to that to really substantiate that Kennedy knew and wanted to find out about what was really going on the ET issue.
On this video interview with Corso about the briefing, did he say specifically what he told Kennedy about?
Yes, it had to do with technology, that it had to do with the project that Corso was working on while at the Pentagon. I mean, he and his job, as he has said, was he was trying to seed corporations with
sure.
With these advanced technologies. And so he told Kennedy about that, and I think there was probably a lot more. I mean, in his book, The Day After Roswell, he talked about his personal involvement with the UFO crash at Roswell, and he also said that the crash material, some of it was basically located in a filing cabinet at the Pentagon, and that his superior, Lieutenant General Trudeau, had ultimate authority over that, and that he had entrusted Corso to that. And the really kind of important thing here is that this substantiates some of the stories that, in fact, President Kennedy did travel secretly to an Air Force base to see some of the Roswell artifacts. And I believe that base was Homestead Air Force Base, pretty much the same base where Nixon
and Gleason went, right?
Exactly, yes, Homestead Air Force Base. And it's on the record that Kennedy traveled around 1962 to Homestead Air Force Base. And so this was probably where he had the opportunity to see it. And this is really, this is another really interesting connection here, George, is that Marilyn Monroe, she was about to spill the beans about Kennedy having traveled to a secret Air Force location to see the remains of an extraterrestrial crash. And that apparently Marilyn Monroe, because she wasn't going to keep quiet about this, that this was something that ultimately led to her murder back in 1962. And so you have a Marilyn Monroe connection as well, that in fact the Kennedy's visit to that secure facility to see the Roswell artifacts actually did happen, and it may well be that it was Corso that maybe told Kennedy where to go.
Boy, those days were something, weren't they, Michael?
It really was an incredible time. I think President Kennedy did make very powerful efforts to get to the bottom of this UFO issue, and I truly think in a way he really was America's last real president. Everyone ever since has been very tightly controlled when it comes to this issue in terms of, you know, what they can say and what they've been briefed about.
Let's move over to Eastern Europe for a moment. There was a Russian television show that talked about one of its elected officials, or appointed, who knows what they really do. But tell us about that story.
Well, that is a really interesting one. This is the governor of the Russian Republic of Kalmykia. His name is Kirsan Ilyuminov, and he basically said that in 1997 that he was taken aboard a UFO and met with extraterrestrials. And the interesting thing about this was that when he was taken away, he had three of his aides come to his apartment, which was a penthouse apartment, to meet him because he was a governor, and obviously he had political aides who would meet him and drive him around and do things for him. So they came to his apartment and couldn't find him anywhere. He was missing. And so they were trying to decide what to do. You know, so his three aides are wondering what in the world has happened to him. He's not here. Well, then the governor said after the ETs finished with him, after they had showed him around and actually had taken him off planet, when they brought him back, I mean, all this happened in the space of a few hours Earth time, but obviously he was with them for a lot longer than that, and that this, you know, this is one of the stories you hear again and again from experiences, that, you know, time passes very differently when you're with an ET, ETs as opposed to what's happening on the Earth. Well, nevertheless, he eventually came back, and his three aides basically said, "Where have you been? You know, we've been looking for you. We've been frantic. We've been thinking of, you know, phoning the authorities and trying to, you know, put out a search." And he just described to them what happened, and from their reactions, he realized that this was not something that people were really going to accept, even though he was a governor. But nevertheless, in May of this year, he appeared on a very popular Russian TV show, and the very first question that was put to him by the host was, you know, what happened on this incident in 1997? And again, this is just one of those examples of, you know, like China, I think you probably have Russia taking initiative in terms of getting or encouraging its official media or the various popular media sources to run stories about UFOs, about extraterrestrial life. Just get the people ready, you know, just get them up to speed about this in case things happen quickly, because this is one of the things that governments ultimately can't control, that certainly you can kind of slow down the amount of information getting out there, intimidate people, withdraw evidence and so forth. But if there ever is to be a catastrophic release of information concerning extraterrestrial life, you know, governments don't want to be in the situation where their people aren't ready for it. And so I think we are seeing with countries like Russia and China that more and more information is being allowed to get out there on these very prominent news media sources to kind of get people thinking about, well, you know, what if this is real? What if in fact, extraterrestrials are coming and visiting us and taking high-profile celebrities or politicians on craft and kind of giving them all sorts of experiences? What if that's really happening? So I think this is a very important development, and it's certainly something to be welcomed.
And this is worldwide too, Michael, isn't it? All these events, they're happening everywhere, aren't they?
They certainly are, George. I mean, it's happening in all major countries. There are just more of these UFO sightings, more examples of prominent individuals coming out to speak about this. A couple of years ago, you had the former defense minister of Japan making statements about UFOs, if they visited Japan, if they hovered over the airspace, and they were friendly, then they wouldn't issue any kind of shoot to kill order. And that's a kind of policy statement. So here you have a defense minister for Japan making a kind of off-the-cuff policy statements about extraterrestrial life. And that was based on the UFO sightings that were happening back then, back in 1998, as I recall. So you're just having more of this happening around the world. You're having more countries releasing UFO files. So the momentum is definitely shifting, and the thing that I'm especially encouraged about is the fact that the scientific community are now officially being encouraged to make exopolitical kind of statements. You know, the statement that Stephen Hawking's made, or the statement that Gabriel Funes made, the astrobiology conferences in the Vatican, the Royal Society of London in January of this year also had an astrobiology conference where the scientists were invited to basically talk about the implications of extraterrestrial life. So things are definitely moving forward.
Now it gets even stranger. We'll be back in a moment with Michael Salas. Stand by. Michael, your latest book, is it still available on Amazon.com or your websites?
Yes, people can go to the website or to Amazon, and they can order the latest one, and certainly they can find out all about my research into the government policies on extraterrestrial life over the last 50, 60 years.
Okay, let's talk, if we can, on why you believe ancient historical reports are so important in the field of exopolitics.
Well, I think when we're looking at this issue purely from the lens of a modern phenomenon, you know, we're overlooking that, in fact, this is something that the ancients described. I mean, there are many ancient texts talking about the kind of advanced technologies that existed at the time and the time of the gods. And when you look at the ancient literature, I mean, like one of the most famous historians of all time was Manetho. He was an Egyptian historian who talked about the ancient history of Egypt. And even back then, the records of Egypt kind of stretched far back in antiquity. So even the historians back in the 5th century BC, they were trying to kind of get to the bottom of what really happened. But he talked about, of course, the 30 dynasties that conventional archaeology studies, but he talked about a time before that, that was the time of the gods, and then there was the time of the demigods. And so if you look at, well, what did he mean by that, you know, the time of the gods? Was this something purely mythological, or was there some basis to this in terms of these beings, these gods actually being extraterrestrials? Well, when you look at the Sumerian records, you have the same phenomenon. You have the king's list. Again, you have a list of, stretching back in antiquity with human kings that were preceded by these gods and then these demigods. And, of course, you have Zechariah Sitchin talking about the role of the Anunnaki. And so when you look at all of these texts and you throw in, like, the Book of Enoch talking about the Nephilim, I think what we have to conclude is that, in fact, extraterrestrial visitation is not purely a modern phenomenon, and that, in fact, this has been something that has existed in humanity's antiquity, and that many of the issues that we face today in fact, were similar to the issues confronting the ancients, which and the biggest issue that I think we're facing today is the kind of way in which some of these advanced technologies are being secretly developed in government and military, corporate, highly classified facilities without any regard to their consequences. And so a lot of these technologies are basically being developed, in my opinion, in a very irresponsible way. And the interesting thing about the ancient historical texts, they describe a very similar situation about how this technology was misused and that this was directly related to the collapse of those societies. And it talked about wars between the gods.
Do you believe that this kind of technology has been so suppressed that we may never be able to get it back? Or do you also think that governments may be using it already in the form of anti-gravity devices and things like that?
Well, I think there are various layers here. I think, when you go down one layer, you probably have some of these secret technologies that have been used for the development of, say, anti-gravity spacecraft, and that you would have, certain military control over that. So you would have, say, the real Space Command with these anti-gravity fleets doing all sorts of things. And that would be under the kind of the control of, say, various Navy, Air Force generals. And that would be a certain layer of technology which is made available to the military. Now, if you go deeper than that, you go into these technologies that have to do with kind of like time travel, creation of super soldiers, moving through kind of space-time portals. All of these really advanced technologies is where you kind of see the lines of control becoming more and more blurry. I think it's taken probably out of the hands of the military and more in the control of these committees that I mentioned earlier that really are escaping any kind of conventional political, government, military oversight and are kind of like really running as rogue entities. And that they, when you go deeper down the kind of onion, in terms of the deepest layers, I think you'll find that some of these technologies are just so advanced that only very few people, and typically those that are tied up with these secret transnational committees and the corporations that are involved with them, really have any great knowledge over.
Tell me about this incredible story about a group of 24 contactees out there.
Well, that is a really amazing story because one of the things I noticed as I was doing my research into the whole kind of ET phenomenon and looking at some of the stories of the contactees, I mean, obviously you're hearing stories about these extraterrestrials flying around in these incredibly advanced technologies, picking up people, civilians, taking them up and giving them kind of like rides in space and introducing them to some of the philosophy. But in some of these stories, I kept on finding very strange beings appearing in there, and that these reports by the contactees were really revealing that, in fact, when it comes to extraterrestrial civilizations, that not all of their most advanced beings are those that understand or use technology, that some of them actually use consciousness, that they would be, in terms of our description, a being of kind of elevated consciousness or super consciousness. And there's one example of this, and it comes from Enrique Castellon Rincon, who was a Colombian contactee from 1974 to around 1976. Just over a period of 2 years, he had several meetings with a group of extraterrestrials from the Pleiades civilization, or star system, I should say, and that some of the visitations were actually witnessed by people in terms of the UFOs being sighted. But in one of the encounters that Rincon had, he said he was taken by the Pleiadians to a remote location in the Andes, and he met with a group of other contactees. That altogether there were 24 contactees from all over the world. They were brought there to basically be trained to be galactic ambassadors, that they would introduce the rest of humanity to advanced extraterrestrial life. And so they were put through a kind of training program, contact, and all sorts of things to do with extraterrestrial life and technology. And pretty much at the end of the training, they were basically asked to come out into the open, and they assembled before a cave. And there, out of the cave, a being came out. Someone just dressed very, very simply in a kind of robe. And according to Rin Kon, this being had this kind of aura or this kind of energy around him. And he said when he looked at the being, he thought, wow, I mean, is this Jesus, the Christ? I mean, he's a very religious person, Enrique. And so he asked that question. And the being kind of immediately picked up what Rin Kon was thinking, and he said, no, I'm not who you think I am, but I am a master of universal wisdom, and I have mastered, and he came up with a figure, I have mastered 35% of universal wisdom. And he talked all about kind of cosmic unity and consciousness and so forth, and then he just kind of, after delivering that monologue, then he just went back into the cave. And what the extraterrestrials were doing was showing that, in fact, even though the contactees were seeing the extraterrestrials as being incredibly advanced in terms of their technology and understanding and so forth, that they were showing the contactees that there are those that are even more evolved than the ETs themselves, but that they are actually evolved in the sense of consciousness, and that these are beings that, you know, I call them celestials. Others might call them angels or ascended masters, Elohim, very different, many terms for these beings. But in fact, that these beings exist, the extraterrestrials know about them and actually work with them and help introduce some of their contactees to these beings, And, you know, I found similar stories in the accounts of George Adansky, Howard Menger, and another contactee from Bolivia that I've worked with, Luis Fernando Mostaja. He also has had experiences in the Lake Titicaca region, where he says that he also had contacts with a group of beings that were part of the Galactic Confederation. That was what he described them as. And that these beings actually introduced him to a similar sort of celestial or ascended master from a kind of a remnants of Atlantean civilization that had a base underneath Lake Titicaca. And so we actually traveled out there to Lake Titicaca, my wife and I and a group of others, and it was a very special place. And, yeah, I could really understand how, you could have some hidden underground facilities there where you have different extraterrestrial groups and even some of these kind of very highly evolved beings of consciousness.
Michael, the George Adamskys of the years gone past, how are they viewed then? How would they be viewed today?
Well, I think people today would be much more favorably disposed towards them. Back in the days of Adamski, Menger, and so forth, people lived under the illusion, and, you know, get this, it's hard to believe, but people really believed that governments were honest. And so if the government said something about someone, then that must be true. So, you know, people like Adamski and Menger and so forth, Adamski in particular, I mean, the FBI set him up on a few occasions and kind of made him look to be a liar, you know, that Adamski was kind of making all these claims about, you know, reporting to the FBI his contact experiences. And, in fact, he was actually reporting to the Pentagon and the authorities what was happening to him. He was being flown. Every time he had a contact experience, a jet was taken to his location in the Los Angeles area, and he was flown to the Pentagon to brief the generals there about the latest information from the Galactics. And so basically what happened was that, even though on the one hand, you know, the government was basically acknowledging that this was a very important person with very significant information that we wanted him to share with us, on the other hand, other factions of the government were basically making out that he was a quack, that he was making it all up, he was a liar, you can't trust the word of it. And so the FBI was involved in that. And they were, you know, part of the overall mechanism by which people like Adamski were discredited. Well, these days, I think now, people would be much more skeptical about what governments have to say about these contactees' experiences. And so I think people would be much more prepared to kind of give, you know, have an open mind and look at all the evidence and look at what Adamski had to support his case. And he actually had a lot of good evidence and a lot of direct witnesses, but all of that was discounted because the authorities basically made it out that he was a quack.
Yeah, well, that's true, too. You talk about the possibility that some witnesses, whistleblowers, could be in some special celestial witness protection program. As far-fetched as it seems, tell me about it.
Well, you know, it's one of the things that I've suspected for some time because, I mean, we've just had more and more whistleblowers coming forward than ever. And, you know, and there's all sorts of kind of rumors about, you know, how they're being protected and so forth in doing that. And you never quite know who the protectors are. Well, there's one whistleblower by the name of Aaron McCollum. He's appeared on the Project Camelot website, two lengthy interviews that have been had with him. And in one of those interviews, he said that eventually he became so depressed over the things that he had done and his kind of his life outlook that he tried to commit suicide. And he said what happened was that he basically made up a cocktail of all of these different drugs that he had at his home. He made this lethal cocktail, took it all, and he was knocked out. And obviously he thought that that was it. Well, the next thing he knows that he wakes up at a hospital, and the doctors have cured him. And it's like, well, he was surprised, and he said, well, what happened? Well, they told him that a kind of mysterious tall person kind of appeared at the hospital carrying him and basically told the doctors exactly what McCollum had taken, you know, the exact amount of drugs,
right,
you know, to the most minute detail in terms of how much he took. And because of that, the doctors were able to kind of come up with what they needed to do to cure him, and he survived. And the doctor said, well, you know, this person told us this information, and then we turned around to kind of get some more information from him, and he disappeared. And so McCollum himself thought that this being was probably one of the extraterrestrials that have been looking out for him. And so I think that that's probably one example, and there are others, of a kind of whistleblower protection program where these extraterrestrials, the more kind of ethical, advanced extraterrestrials, are helping on protecting whistleblowers so that they can do their work without being eliminated. And McCollum has been targeted a few times for assassination but has always kind of mysteriously survived. And so, you know, I think he's just one of many examples.
It's a dramatic story, Michael. It may be one of the biggest ever once it really unfolds, don't you think?
Oh, this is an incredible story. I mean, this whole thing has so many different layers. It really is a really complex onion, and the deeper you go, the more convoluted it becomes. But the information is just so mind-boggling that you've got to go deeper. And each time you think you've kind of found just how deep it goes, there's another layer that opens up. And, you know, I think ultimately when this comes out, people are going to be shocked so much that it will revolutionize their thinking. It'll change everything on the planet in terms of our philosophy. It'll change science, of course, politics, commerce. Everything will change. And I don't think we have all that much to wait.
You know, there are some who always wonder why, if there are ETs out there, they don't come and bail us out. Why haven't they fixed the oil spill? Why haven't they taken care of famine and wars? Why don't they do that?
Well, I think this is part of the historical question as well. When we look at history, we see that extraterrestrials did intervene. And when they did intervene, it didn't always turn out too well because when they intervened, they were regarded as gods. And basically, humanity surrendered their power to them because, you know, I mean, obviously, if you're witnessing a more highly evolved technological civilization appear in your world and suddenly giving you all of these advanced technologies, curing all of these incurable illnesses, solving all of these intractable problems, environmental problems, and so forth, then, you know, there's a certain amount of kind of adulation, and then you regard these beings as gods, and that seems to be what happened in the ancient history. And I think when we're looking at the modern era, the extraterrestrials don't want to fall into that trap again because it didn't work in the past. It failed. I mean, whatever kind of advances were brought about in the societies that they intervene in, they were only temporary. Eventually, these societies imploded because they simply weren't ready for the advanced technologies. And I think this is probably something that those extraterrestrials watching us are aware of, that unless we learn to become more ethical and evolve more in terms of our responsibility and consciousness, then if we're given these advanced technologies, if they become kind of freely available to the mass public, then, you know, we're likely to follow history and implode. And certainly if they intervene to just kind of like overtly solve our problems, you know, we wouldn't grow. We wouldn't learn from our mistakes. And obviously I think they're kind of like probably just doing low-key things in behind the scenes, you know, for example, like the Chernobyl radiation leak in the 1980s, I believe it was, that you know, there were UFOs sighted there, and so they kind of helped out, make sure that the radiation wasn't too bad. I think they helped out during the Cold War to make sure nuclear war didn't break out. So I think they've intervened behind the scenes in a kind of low key way, but I don't think they're going to intervene in any overt way to kind of solve our problems, because I think they understand that that would actually hinder our evolution.
Yeah, maybe. Well, when we come back in just a moment, Michael, we'll take phone calls with you. Fascinating discussion, and some of the stories that you've uncovered truly are remarkable. Michael's website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We'll be right back. Don't touch your dial. And Michael, what are you working on in the future? What's next for you?
Well, I'm just working more on this question of the celestials and their relationship with extraterrestrials. I think that there is a lot of issues surrounding the responsible use of technology, and that we need to be able to kind of balance that technological development with the kind of ethical evolution as a species. And so that's something that I'm personally am more committed to, and so that'll be what I'll be working on for the next year or two.
Some of the people in the field that you admire, who would they be?
Well, I do admire those that have been working in this field of exopolitics, looking at the political implications of ET life. The person who I think has probably done most work in this area, people like Stephen Greer, Steve Bassett has also done quite a lot in that. And others like Wendell Stevens, who's kind of one of my unsung heroes because of the early work he did in just making available a lot of the contactee stories. And he's certainly probably one of the most experienced UFO researchers in the world.
You know, what I like about the field too, Michael, is the specialists that are there in certain areas. You know, those who deal with abductions, those who deal, like you do, with exopolitics. Stanton Friedman, who has this broader approach. I mean, everybody brings to the table some area of their own expertise, and I think that's important.
It sure is. It's kind of like a university department in a way, informally, where you have one department that might be dedicated to a particular discipline, you know, whether it's political science or sociology. But within that, you have all these different fields, and people kind of specialize in those fields. But overall, they're kind of working within this rubric of a particular discipline. And so for all of us involved in exopolitics or UFO research, we have a very shared interest in the UFO ET question, but we have very different approaches and emphases and skills.
All right, to the phones we go now. Let's go to Jim in Maine. Questions or stories? Go ahead, Jim. You're on with us.
Hey, welcome back there, George.
Thanks, Jim.
Give you a toot on the old truck. Shoot the load.
There you go.
Yeah, hey, I'm just curious. I've heard stories about these ETs that actually eat the flesh of livestock, and I believe that they possibly could be demonic entities that are actually just trying to keep us off the main track of why we're here. I think they could be demonic angels, one of the third that fell from heaven. What do you think about that?
I think we need to keep a couple of things in mind here, is that There are those that do put out information about ETs that tries to skew it in a particular direction that basically raises the fear factor. Because if you put people in a place of fear, they're easy to manipulate. You know, when you're frightened of anything, certain brain areas are stimulated, and they tend to predominate over kind of more advanced or higher functioning brain areas. So if you make people fearful about the ET issue, that means then they're going to be looking at kind of like more simplistic solutions to it. Now, that's not saying that these things don't happen, because I think in many ways ETs are like us. You know, you have the whole spectrum of those that are really incredibly ethical and benevolent, and those that come at the other end who are really self-serving and kind of predatory. And so I think we have the whole range, and we just need to be discerning. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, just like any society, you're going to have your, you know, most are going to be kind of law-abiding, ethical people, beings, and you're going to have a kind of criminal class. And I think ETs are probably the same. You have a small criminal class, but I think that they're pretty much kind of controlled or monitored by the broader segment. So I hope that kind of answers your question.
Michael, you've talked a little bit about the movie Avatar and how that somehow ties into some of the things that we've been talking about tonight. Explain that.
Well, I think it's a very important movie. I think it works on a number of levels. You know, obviously there are the archetypal levels that James Cameron is kind of like using in the movie, in terms of being able to kind of step into, you know, into a more evolved state of being where, you know, we are functioning at a higher level. On the other hand, I think there are some very important political messages kind of embedded in there. I thought it was really interesting the way he described or set up the whole kind of the movie in terms of corporations being in charge, that when it came to colonization of space, it wasn't governments that were in charge, it was corporations, and that these corporations were really kind of like unscrupulous entities that were, you know, really trying to maximize the dollar when they were going out there colonizing space. And I think there's a really important political message kind of embedded in there. I don't know if Cameron was aware of it consciously, or whether just unconsciously he realized that in fact that is very much the problem that we have, that we are pretty much on the verge of secretly becoming, if we don't become aware and familiar with the issues, that we will very shortly become, if we haven't already, a colonizing space power that is dominated by corporations, and that the majority of humanity and our legislative, political bodies won't have any influence over it at all. It'll just be these corporations that have these contracts to kind of mine a certain planet or take over a certain population, and I think that would be really horrible. And the Avatar movie, I think, is waking us up to that kind of possibility.
I find it to be very poetic that Cameron was one of the first to go to BP with some recommendations and suggestions on how to seal up this oil spill.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Let's go to Denver now in Colorado. Rose is there, west of the Rockies. Hey, Rose, good morning.
Hi, George.
Hi.
I want to thank you. I've emailed you and asked you to pray for me, and I appreciate that.
Absolutely.
I appreciate what you do. I have systemic lupus, and I'm an abductee, and the aliens that abduct me are the grays and the mantis beings. They're not nice at all.
How long has this been going on, Rosie?
Since I was about 3 years old. They are very nasty to me. Dr. Jacobs and Bud Hopkins have helped me a great deal. I got to the point where I was going to put a 45 to my head, and they helped me. And I want to ask Dr. Sala, why don't the other beings intervene when people are victimized to the point that I am? I'm ill, and they still abduct me. I am 61 years old, and they're still abducting me.
Well, I'm really sorry to hear, Rose, about your situation. why others don't step in. I think there's a kind of basic law of non-intervention. And when we look at the kind of political environment whereby certain agreements have been made between government corporate entities and certain extraterrestrial races, and that some of these agreements have sanctioned abductions, and even though certain limits and conditions were put in place, I think nevertheless, in principle, what we have is that there has been a certain degree of government complicity or sanctioning of that phenomenon, and which means that these beings that do this can say to anyone else wanting to intervene, you know, we're talking about a kind of more highly evolved ethical being wanting to intervene, that that they have no right, that in fact government has given them authority to intervene and work with citizens, private individuals in that way. That doesn't quite help you, just knowing that. What I would recommend is to maybe kind of look at ways to try and raise your own consciousness or build up certain skills so that you can deal with these beings in a way where you feel empowered rather than disempowered all the time. It's not an easy thing to do, but if you send me an email, I can maybe go into more detail into some of the things you might be able to do.
Okay, thanks, Rose. Good luck to you. Let's go to Floyd in Mississippi, Gulf Coast area. Go ahead there, Floyd.
Hello, George and Michael. Thank you. I'm a first-time caller from the Mississippi Gulf Coast, home of the BP disaster.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, I have a question here. I've really been listening to this conversation. I've been waiting for it all night. One of the things that I see a lot of, even the ancient aliens, by the way, George, you were great in that.
Well, thank you.
There's a lot of talk about what's going on the moon. And my question is there any evidence that there's been ruins found or that any of the governments on this planet have a base there and are doing anything there?
Well, there is the work of those that have been photographing the moon or using satellite images of the moon, that there has been a number of books put out concerning structures on the moon. A lot of the kind of early Viking satellite images, some of the Apollo images of the moon, that some of these have very anomalous structures up there. And so there has been a kind of real cottage industry built up around that. Glenn Steckling wrote a book about bases on the moon. Another person by the name of George Leonard, if I'm correct, he also wrote about it. And he was one of the people that actually his work helped substantiate what Ingo Swann was recruited to do. Ingo mm-hmm. Swann was the remote viewer, and he was asked to basically see what he could find on the moon. And he found certain structures up there and certain beings up there that he assumed were extraterrestrials. And then in terms of validation, he was sent a book by this Leonard gentleman, and that the book kind of like had structures and diagrams in there that validated what Ingo Swann was seeing kind of through remote viewing mechanisms. So that was also corroboration that there was stuff happening up there. And of course, Richard Hoagland, as I'm sure you're very familiar with, George, has spoken at length about what's up there on the moon.
Absolutely. Now, was that to Leonard Stringfield, by the way, who sent that on to Ingo?
No, it wasn't Leonard Stringfield. I thought it was a Leonard, but I can't remember the full name. But certainly, if you read Ingo Swann's account of what happened with Axelrod, James Axelrod, as I recall, in terms of having to remote view the moon, he'll mention that Axelrod said sent him a book, and that this book validated what he had seen up there. It wasn't Steckling's book. It was another gentleman.
And Stringfield, of course, died in 1994. What a great researcher he was, Michael.
Well, that's right. He was before my time, actually. I really only got involved in this field in 2001. So I never got to meet him, meet with him or talk to him, as well as I never got to meet with or talk with John Mack. I would have loved to have done that.
How about Hynek? I assume you didn't meet him, did you?
No, I didn't meet him. Okay. But my colleague Paula Harris has told me all about these people. So she's met them, and so she kind of, so I work closely with Paula. She's probably listening, and I say hi to Paula. She's a very close colleague.
Let's elaborate just a little bit more on what you were talking about, the astrobiology conferences held by the Vatican and the Royal Society of London. Something's going on there, Michael.
Well, that's right. There's been a real shift here. In 2009, what we had was just a remarkable degree of openness by government entities scientific bodies on the ET or UFO issue. And the Vatican really played a prominent role in that. I mean, the Vatican was, through its chief astronomer, was allowing these statements to be published on its on the Vatican's newspaper, official newspaper, L'Osservatore, that's published in Rome. And here you had Gabriel Furness, the astronomer, basically making all of these statements about extraterrestrials being our brothers, and that there was nothing incompatible in terms of belief in extraterrestrials with the Christian faith, and really kind of setting out the basis for how the Catholic world can really embrace the ET issue. And then the Vatican sponsored this conference in November of last year. Furness was the chief organizer, but the Vatican sponsored it, so it put up money. So this is, you know, a serious thing, and the Vatican was flying over some of the world's leading astrobiologists and thinkers on this field of astrobiology, and they had a really productive conference and issued a report. And then after that, you had probably one of the world's most prestigious scientific bodies, the Royal Society of London, mm-hmm. having its own conference in January, dealing again with extraterrestrial life and its implications. And I think what we're seeing here is a real opening up of the scientific community to the question of extraterrestrial life. And, you know, and I think what is really going to be a big shot in the arm for kind of scientific interest is as more of these exoplanets are discovered that are kind of Earth size, that's going to revolutionize thinking.
Okay, let's go to our Skype caller. Michael is in Normandy, France. There you go. Go ahead, Michael. Good morning.
Good morning, George and Michael. Yes, I'd like to relay an incident I had. I was a security specialist on Pease Air Force Base. We worked with our aircraft that was nuclear loaded, and they would go to Russia at any time, alert aircraft. And in October of 1975, I was just getting ready to get out, and we had an alert status go off, except it wasn't a full exercise, and our pilots had jumped in their planes, and they took off to Russia. And what I found out a little while after that was that the screen showed incoming Russian missiles. Well, the pilots got about a quarter of the way to Russia and came back. The next day, they got halfway to Russia. And this was right after an incident, about 2 weeks after an incident on the base, where we had a very large green glowing object land at the end of the runway. And the area supervisor went out there. The thing shot off. And our radar from our base in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, all the way to Logan Airport in Boston went snowy that night after this ship took off. 1975 on that base was very interesting. We had all kinds of sightings over the base. And in that time frame, I guess a lot of other bases did too. I don't know if anyone's heard about that or not, but I'd be curious if Michael had heard anything about that time period. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And I guess sometimes we're a little bit more than coast to coast We're planet to planet. Go ahead, Mark.
Yes. Well, one day you might take an off-planet call. You never know.
That's right. We'll have an ET call on our Skype line.
Well, that's a really interesting story about Pierce Air Force Base and the planes being scrambled, and you have these incoming missiles that actually turned out to be UFOs. That reminded me of what Robert Dean talked about in terms of when he was stationed at NATO's headquarters in Paris in 1963, that in fact a high-level study was commissioned because that kind of phenomenon was happening, that there was what appeared to be missiles kind of coming from east to west, you know, coming from the Warsaw Pact into NATO countries, and that as it turned out that they were UFOs, and so they basically began to do a high-level study to find out, well, what's going on with this, because obviously if we confuse these UFOs with a nuclear missile attack, then, you know, we could have an accidental nuclear war. And so it seems as though something similar to that was happening at Pierce Air Force Base, and that wouldn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, those things almost happen too, Michael. Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment. We'll take final phone calls. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Michael, in your career, what has been for you the most fascinating extraterrestrial UFO story you've ever heard?
Well, I am most impressed with the kind of early contactee reports. I mean, those are the most incredible, where people would be just picked up and you know, met and picked up and taken to a location. And some of those early stories that Adamski talked about, where he was met at hotels and then driven to remote locations and taking up on the vehicle, on a space vehicle, and then held all these incredible experiences. Those are pretty amazing.
Yeah, they sure are. Let's go to final calls now. We'll pick it up by going to Woonsocket, Rhode Island. Richard, east of the Rockies. Hey, Richard, good morning.
Hello. Forgive the hum, Mr. Norrie.
Ah, got it. Okay.
Okay. You know, I've been briefed on your site, Dr. Sala. I just want to exalt those who are very, very dedicated in elder wiseness. And I'll mention three names, including Dr. Edgar Mitchell. And the thing is, the first name was Raymond Fowler. I'm sure you guys are familiar with him. He's a Bible scholar, master's in Christian Bible theology and Eastern religions, and he's from the National Security Agency. And he's been into this stuff for about 56 years. The other fellow was Dr. Don Elkins, who's a fighter pilot, airline pilot, got a PhD in mechanical engineering and physics. But I emphasize the nuts and bolts background, you know, and they've been into this for about 48, 58 years. And the third one was Ed Mitchell's buddy, Ejack Bentor. Barbara McLeod had mentioned one time, and callers will mention it mercurially, his book, Stalking the Wild Pendulum on the Mechanics of Consciousness. You know, he talks about hyperdimensional energy, meditation, the creator, and how all the system of, you know, spirituality and physics works. But with Dr. Don Elkins, he came out with the fact that he was best friends with Dr. J. Allen Hynek. And one of the guests, and a caller, I mentioned the Law of One, I think it's from the humble messenger named Ra. Now, it sounds funny. It's, channelers, you know, here we go again. But when I went over this particular material, he had a subject by the name of Carla Rucker, was a born-again Christian and had a master's in library science, an English major. And George McCarty had about the same credentials. And Dr. Elkins spent a lot of time with that, as well as his factual research. And when I got into Dr. Lazarette, the karate expert, his stuff, he's a psychologist, right, and metaphysics, he's top-notch in defense. I went back to him, and he recommended Brotherhood of the White Temple College, because he's a graduate, as well as work with the cops, commandos, and everything, kids, you know, you name it. And when I went over their material, it was the same schemata, fellas, as what Raymond Moody was talking about. And what Raymond Fowler was saying was that Bud Hopkins and Charles Haynes seemed to miss what Dr. Sala is delineating here, is that there's a spiritual, theological element to this, and that it's hyperdimensional. And you know, Michael Cremo made a wonderful, wonderful comment last week. He says, we've been 500 or 600 years behind the times. And Uncle George has been nagging us about this for a long time, to tune in and do the meditation and everything, you know, and you start getting into stuff like this and it piles up, you know.
Well, there's no doubt. What do you think of this consciousness aspect of this, Michael?
Well, as I said before, it really is an important topic, and thank you, Richard, for bringing up Don Elkin and Carla Rucart. We actually had Carla Rucart and Jim McCarthy come out to Hawaii and participate in our annual Earth Transformation Conference. I know George has it linked up there on the website.
Yeah.
So we have these speakers come in every year, and we had Carla Rucart there, and she talked about the raw material and the consciousness raising effect, and she actually mentioned the congruity with the material that I had been putting out in terms of U.S. government policy and so forth, and she very kindly gifted me with a kind of fifth book. That there's four books that make up the raw material, but there was a fifth book that was kind of like not really prominently put out there, but she gave me that, and just commenting on the similarity in terms of the things that I've been saying and what she's saying. And I just wanted to say finally, because I know there's not much time left, that the raw material really was one of the pioneering works, and in terms of emphasizing the importance of consciousness raising. And it talked about this kind of the harvest and this period in humanity's history where basically if people's consciousness has reached a certain point, then we're ready to evolve from one kind of density plane into another. But the really interesting thing about it was that back in 1983, way before anyone was talking about it, they mentioned that this would happen around 2011, that this harvest would happen then. That was the period. And so, this was well before people began talking about 2012 and the whole kind of end of the Mayan calendar. So, that period in terms of it being a critical point in our evolution as a species from one density into another density, more refined density where we have a higher consciousness and are able to do more things, it was really the raw material that was the first to put that out.
You know, Michael, I was thinking about some of the Hollywood movies of UFOs and ET visitations that have been done to either educate us or to let us know what was going on. And it's amazing, like the original black and white Day the Earth Stood Still, one of the classics. And then we got into Close Encounters of the Third Kind with Richard Dreyfuss, ET the Extraterrestrial, and a couple more of my favorites, The Abyss and Contact. But they all have certain messages behind them. Have you noticed that?
I think that they're kind of almost like messages that wake people up. I mean, I do think that there's a – I don't think it's just movies either. I think it's crop circles, that these critical movies, that they have an effect of kind of activating people. It's like I know myself. It's just like in 2001, I was woken up. I mean, it was like someone turned on the light and I could not go back to what I was doing. The thought of teaching international politics at a university, even though it was a really prestigious career in many ways, it just seemed so dull compared to what I had been turned on to, and I just couldn't do it, and no matter how hard I tried. And I remember sitting in front of kind of all these job applications that I could have applied for or these jobs, and I couldn't do it. And it's because there was a switch that was turned on. And for me, it was that Disclosure Project press conference. For someone else, it might be watching the Day the Earth Stood Still or a crop circle. I think within us, we have all of these kind of mysteries and all of these kind of hidden parts of who we are. And once it's activated, we can't go back.
No, we can't. Let's go to Jen in Ohio. Hey, Jen, go ahead. You're up with us.
Yes, hello. I had two comments.
Sure.
One is when disclosure does happen, and I think it might, I don't think the government's ever going to come out and disclose. I think it's going to be forced by chips showing up in the sky kind of thing. But I think the most shocking thing for some people is that some of the beings visiting us are human. And I mentioned Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I think, in a way, if you remember in that movie, he started, just not him, but there are people all over the world that started having dreams and visions of Devil's Tower or whatever. And it was like on some telepathic channel, the contact was being made to individuals all over the planet. And I think that's occurring now, too.
Well, thanks for bringing that up, Jen, because that's something that's overlooked a lot, that there are so many stories about greys and reptilians and abductions and so forth that people overlook that really the field began with many stories, many positive, uplifting stories about contact with these human-looking extraterrestrials. And, you know, many of the early contactees from the 50s, 60s, and even early 70s all talked about human-looking extraterrestrials that were often just very attractive beings. And, there was some, it was enormous public interest in it. And I believe some of the conferences that George Van Tassel organized there at Giant Rock, I mean, they had, what, 11,000 people going to these conferences, to these conventions, and just incredible public interest. But I think that, in a way, you hit the nail on the head when you said that this was very dangerous. It was dangerous to the government, because government didn't want the public to know that there were these really beautiful-looking, human-looking extraterrestrials out there meeting people and introducing them to philosophy and advanced technology and spirituality. They didn't want that to happen. They wanted to introduce the fear factor, and the fear factor was the gray extraterrestrials, and they've been very successful in that.
Okay, great. Couple more callers to go. Mac in New Orleans and Louisiana. Go ahead, Mac. Hi.
Hey, how y'all doing this morning, guys?
Good.
Hey, I'd like to mention, George, one thing real quick. I got a question for Michael, but I'd like to mention that Coast to Coast is a great diversion for everything that's been going on down here with the with BP, you know, BP oil spill,
yeah.
and then before even back to Katrina. So the show's great. I'd like to ask Michael a question on implants. First, what percentage of abductees would you say all have implants? And I have a comment on implants, too. Wouldn't it make sense? I've seen several documentaries where they take the implant and they take a look at it and they say, well, it's just normal material. Well, wouldn't that make sense that if the ETs want to be as elusive as they can, that they wouldn't use anything from Zeta Reticuli, they'd use something from here?
Well, in terms of how many implants are out there, I think you probably would begin by an estimate of how many abductees there are out there. And I believe it was Alan Hynek and David Jacobs and Bud Hopkins. I think they organized some survey, and I think they came up with a figure of kind of like several million were abductees. And I would say probably the majority of those would probably have these kind of these tracking devices in them, and the kind of implants. What they're made out of, I guess they are made out of some advanced technology with some kind of biological material, so that the body doesn't reject it. And they've been doing that for a number of years, and I'm sure they're expert enough to be able to make miniaturize them enough so that very few people can spot them.
Okay, let's go to Endicott, New York. Guy's turn on Coast to Coast. Good morning, Guy.
Hi, George. How are you? You and Art Bell are the best of the best of the best.
Oh,
I've been wanting to tell you this story for a long time. In April of 08, around the 15th or the 16th, I'm not sure exactly what day it was, my wife was living right outside of White Plains, New York, near Wacabuc, New York. And it was around 8 o'clock in the evening. And my wife said to me, she's going to take a walk outside. I said, okay, go. About 5 or 6 minutes later, I decided to walk outside after her. And I just happened to take a look up in the sky. And I saw a black object, a quiet black object, triangular. Well, actually, mm-hmm. It wasn't triangular. It was like home plate, all right, in a baseball.
Yeah.
And it was unbelievable, and it lasted for about maybe 15 or 16 seconds. And I looked at my wife, and I said to her, I said, you just saw a UFO. It was there, and it just disappeared.
How big was it, Guy?
It was huge.
Yeah.
And I called Westchester Airport, and, of course, you know, they said, there's no such sighting. We didn't see anything or anything like that. But, you know, I've always believed in this. And to see it firsthand is really something else. And I have wanted to call you and tell you that, because I never saw it like I saw it.
And with it being so silent, that must have been eerie, Guy.
Very eerie. And something else, George, it was a beautiful, beautiful evening. The sky was purple. It was just, it was around 8:15 in the spring, and this black object just stood right out.
Michael, we've heard a lot of reports about this object.
It reminds me of the Cass Landrum case. I remember it was a kind of diamond-shaped UFO, very big, that was being kind of tracked, and that it resulted in some people being badly burned. I know in this case, Guy didn't kind of have any negative effect, but it seems that there are these UFOs that are diamond-shaped. I guess that kind of fits the description that that Guy gave, and they're huge. One thing you did say that the radar didn't pick it up. I know in doing some of the research on the way in which the FAA kind of monitors air traffic is that the modern radar in the United States, and you may know this, George, is that it's designed in a way where anything larger than, say, you know, two times a jumbo jet is automatically registered as a cloud, and therefore the radar will not show it. So you could have a kind of mile-wide UFO that's picked up on radar, but the radar will register it as a cloud, and it won't appear on the UFO. It won't appear on the radar. So that's why often you do have FAA kind of commenting, oh, well, no, we didn't see anything, even though it was a huge UFO. It's because the equipment is designed to kind of factor that out, such large objects.
Do you think that we got more solid UFO cases back in the 50s than we do now?
Well, I think in the 40s and the 50s, the big difference was that many military sources were allowed to come forward. Many pilots were able to report what had happened. Radar evidence was released. In fact, Donald Kehoe, back in the early 1950s, was given access to some of these UFO reports by the Air Force, and he actually published it in one of his early books. And so it was kind of unprecedented, and it's never been repeated. In 1954 was when they passed the JNAP regulation, Joint Army-Navy Air Publication 164, I believe, and that basically made it illegal for military pilots or anyone in the civilian airline industry to report to the general public any UFO that was being covered under that JNAP protocol, and so that's when everything went quiet. But those early reports are the best, and I don't think anything that has happened since then comes close to those early reports, which really proved, to my mind, the reality of this issue being extraterrestrial in nature. And Donald Kehoe was the first to kind of like really emphasize that the evidence was overwhelming, that we are being visited by extraterrestrials, and that was back in the 50s.
Let's get one more quick question. And Joshua in Lafayette, Louisiana, only have about a minute left. Josh, go ahead.
George, glad to talk to you, man. Listen to you every chance I get.
Thank you.
Make this quick. Ever since the oil spills happened, I've seen double the amount of chemtrails down here. I mean, it's just like spiderwebs certain evenings. I mean, they're just all over the place. And then almost you can set your clock by it almost about 2 hours after you start noticing them, which is late in the evening, you'll start seeing, by the time it starts getting dark, all kinds of lights. I mean, I'm talking lights. Now, these things are moving twice the speed of what your fighter jets move. I mean, and we don't really have a Air Force base real close other than Barksdale or Fort Polk. Any ideas why there might be more chemtrails now that the oil spill?
That's interesting. 30 seconds, Michael. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I think with the chemtrails, it may have something to do with the fact that it allows the atmosphere to conduct certain electromagnetic energies that might be part of some kind of pulse-generated electromagnetic wave that could be used against extraterrestrials.
Well, we know one thing, Michael. We know they are everywhere. Michael, thanks so much for being on the program. Again, another stellar job by you. For Dan Galante, Jason King, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then. Be safe, everyone.